Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, your lines are on listen only throughout today's conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Linda Feinberg, President of NAFD Dispute Resolution.
Thank you, and welcome, and thank you for participating in today's workshop and showing your interest in keeping current on the latest issues important to NASD arbitrators. This is our fifth call-in workshop. Three of the prior ones dealt with specific topics, discovery, expungement, and mediation. The most recent, similar to this one, provided an overview of new developments in dispute resolution. Audio recordings of all of our workshops are available on our website at www.nasd.com under Resources for Neutrals. MCI will offer a recording of today's workshop for the next 30 days. A recording will then be exclusively available on our website. We'll give more information about this at the end of the call. We'll begin with an update on dispute resolution's recent activities and latest rule changes. Joining me today is George Friedman, who will give a refresher on Rule 2130, dealing with expungement. We'll end the workshop with a question and answer session to respond to questions submitted by you prior to the workshop. Let's begin with a summary of major accomplishments for 2005. Parties filed just over 6,000 cases with us last year, and we closed more than 9,000 cases. There was a measurable decrease in case processing time thanks to a combination of staff initiatives and arbitrators' diligence in setting prompt hearing dates. Cases closed, on average, more than 1 month faster in 2005 than in 2004. Regarding trends in case filings, common stock continues to be the most frequent product about which parties complain. However, mutual funds and annuities continue to be the subject of a larger percentage of claims than in the past. The most often cited types of controversies alleged continue to be breach of fiduciary duty and negligence, while claims alleging margin calls and omission of facts declined significantly from prior years. In 2005, we achieved an important milestone by introducing a new business model in two of our regional offices. The new model increases the flexibility and efficiency of the administrative process and improves customer service. After a pilot period, our Northeast Regional Office implemented the new model in May, and our Mid-Atlantic office followed in December. The new business model will roll out in our Southeast, Western, and Midwest offices later this year. A main feature of the new model is the establishment of an information specialist. This is a major change for arbitrators in the way your cases will be administered. The main responsibility of the information specialist is to answer general or case-specific phone calls from arbitrators, parties, and their representatives. We created this position to give our users immediate access to a pool of information staff ready to assist you. When you are appointed to a case, you may notice that your case was assigned to the processing center. The processing center consists of a team of legal assistants and clerical staff who work together to process the cases. Managers oversee the performance of the center to ensure that cases are processed accurately and efficiently. After the initial pre-hearing conference, when arbitrators schedule dates for evidentiary hearings, we reassign the case to a case administrator. This person oversees the case until the arbitrators render an award or the parties reach a settlement. Staff members, referred to as logistical assistants, may also contact you. The logistical assistants interact with the panel and the parties to obtain decisions on postponement requests and to schedule pre-hearing conferences and hearings. Arbitrators who participated in focus groups after we completed the pilot in the Northeast generally were pleased with how their cases were handled under the new model. We're confident that you also will be pleased with the efficiencies made possible by this new model. In March 2005, we completed an ambitious initiative to have hearing locations in every single state. We now have hearing sites in 68 cities with at least one in each state. We also have hearing locations in Puerto Rico and London. Our goal is to improve investor access to our forum. I want to emphasize the important role of arbitrators in helping to improve investor access to our forum, particularly in our new locations. We continue to actively recruit new arbitrators to serve in all underrepresented cities. We encourage you to nominate new arbitrator candidates, especially those in close proximity to our new hearing locations. You can find a list of our hearing locations on our website. In 2005, we again held 5 focus groups, this past year's with arbitrators, mediators, party representatives, and state regulators in several of our new hearing locations. During these meetings, we solicited suggestions on how to improve our arbitration and mediation programs and how to better support our constituents. During the focus groups, parties spoke very favorably about our online training modules and encouraged us to continue creating them. Participants also were greatly interested in our mediation program, which continues to show an 80% settlement rate. Finally, we discussed arbitrator recruitment in the new hearing locations. Participants agreed to forward suggestions about specific groups or individuals whom we might contact for potential service as arbitrators. Speaking of arbitrator recruitment, we continue to actively recruit new arbitrators for our roster. If you know people who may be interested, please encourage them to email Neil McCoy, that's N-E-I-L-M-C-C-O-Y, and his web address is neil.mccoy@nasd.com. Neil also is happy to speak to potential applicants. His phone number is 212-858-4283. Those were some of the highlights of 2005. Next, I will discuss some important aspects of our rules and procedures that directly affect arbitrators. One significant rule change that we believe will please many of you concerns an additional honorarium for arbitrators ruling on discovery-related motions. Today, parties generally file one or more discovery motions. Often, they are difficult and time-consuming. To ease this burden on arbitrators, the SEC approved a proposed rule change to compensate arbitrators for ruling on discovery-related motions. Here are some details. A discovery-related motion, along with any replies or other correspondence relating to it, will be treated as a single motion. Each arbitrator who participates in deciding a discovery-related motion will be compensated $200. The panel will allocate this cost to the parties at the end of the case. This rule is effective for all discovery orders issued on and after last September 26th, 2005. Next, I'll discuss the benefits of the direct communication rule that went into effect in 2004. This rule allows parties in an arbitration to communicate directly with the arbitrators if all the parties and all the arbitrators agree. When using the direct communication rule, there are 8 basic guidelines to follow. First, the rule may only be used when all parties are represented by counsel and when all appointed arbitrators agree to apply the rule. Second, Parties may send directly to the arbitrator only those items that are listed in the arbitrator's order. That is, those items to which you have agreed. Any other items must be sent to the DR staff for distribution to the arbitrators. Third, parties may send items by regular mail, overnight courier, fax, or email. All the arbitrators and the parties to a case must be able to send and receive faxes and emails if that's the chosen method of delivery. Fourth, copies of all materials sent to the arbitrators must also be sent simultaneously using the same method to all parties and to dispute resolution. Simply stated, that means that a party cannot fax a document to the arbitrators while sending the same document to the other parties by Pony Express or U.S. Mail. Five, there is one exception to the above. When parties send materials that exceed 15 pages to us, that is to dispute resolution, they must send those by regular mail or overnight courier. Six, we must receive copies of any orders and decisions that result from direct communications among the parties and the arbitrators. Seventh, ex-party communication is strictly prohibited. This means that parties cannot communicate orally with the arbitrators outside the presence of all parties. And finally, any party or arbitrator may terminate the direct communication order at any time after giving written notice to the other parties and to the arbitrators. Since the rule went into effect, we've received very positive feedback from parties and arbitrators who have used it. We encourage you to try direct communication in your cases. If you want to learn more, please go to the arbitrator training section of our website and sign up for our new online mini course on this rule. Finally, we continue to emphasize concern about elderly or seriously ill parties. In June 2004, we launched a program to expedite cases involving elderly or seriously ill parties. Since that time, parties in 293 cases have participated in the program. Under this program, awards were rendered on average within 12.4 months after a case was filed, reducing by more than 4 months the average time to process a case. While staff cannot shorten the time requirements set forth in our code, we can, upon request, speed up the time to complete several staff functions. The parties, of course, can do what the staff cannot do. By mutual agreement, the parties can reduce specific time requirements contained in the code. Arbitrators will generally learn at the initial pre-hearing conference of a party's request for an expedited hearing under this rule. If the arbitrators find that the request has merit, they should schedule hearing dates and discovery deadlines that will expedite the process, of course, while still providing a fair amount of time for case preparation. As arbitrators, you should be sensitive to the needs of the elderly or the seriously ill parties when resolving discovery disputes and determining the reasonableness of postponements. These procedures offer a valuable service for a special segment of our customer base, and we have received positive feedback from parties who have participated in the program. Now let's look ahead to rule changes we anticipate this year in 2006. In an effort to make the pre-hearing discovery process more orderly and efficient, we filed a proposed rule change with the SEC in 2005. Shortly, we will file an amended version with the Commission staff. This is our subpoena process rule. The subpoena rule, first, will give authority to issue subpoenas only to arbitrators. And second, it will provide that a party who receives documents in response to a non-party subpoena will need to make copies of the documents available to all the other parties upon request, with the requesting party to bear the copying costs. We are not amending the other parts of the proposal, which requires 10 days notice and an opportunity to object before a non-party subpoena may be issued. In July 2005, we filed a proposed rule change with the SEC to amend our arbitrator classification rules. The proposal is a further enhancement to our classification initiatives to preclude individuals with ties to the securities industry from serving as public arbitrators. Our proposal amends the definition of public arbitrator to exclude individuals who work for or who are officers or directors of an entity that is in a control relationship with a broker dealer, or who have a spouse or immediate family member who works for or is an officer or director of such an entity. Our proposal further amends the rules to clarify that individuals registered through broker dealers may not be public arbitrators, even if they are not employed by the broker dealer. Comment period on this rule expired in September, and we are awaiting approval. We filed a proposal with the SEC in March of last year to amend the rules to allow customers the option of requiring arbitrators to include an explanation of their decision in an award. The SEC received 200 comment letters on this proposal and has asked us to respond. Upon completion of our review of the comments, we plan to recommend certain amendments to the proposal, and we will file those amendments later this year. Last, but certainly not least, you may remember my report during the last workshop about the proposed revisions to our code. So where are we now? Our project divides the code into three separate parts: the customer code, the industry code, and the mediation code. These codes use plain English, the active voice, and shorter sentences. We hope to achieve three important goals with this new format: to reorganize the rules so that they appear in the chronological order of a typical arbitration proceeding, to codify well-established procedures, and to implement certain substantive changes to help streamline and simplify case administration. I'm delighted to report that the mediation code, the first of the three proposed codes to be approved by the SEC, became effective on January 30 of this year. That code contains no substantive changes, but it does, however, have a comprehensive definitions rule, which includes definitions of the terms used throughout the code. Next, the industry and customer codes. We received about 50 thoughtful comments on these codes. To address them, we will shortly file with the SEC responses to the comments along with some minor enhancements to the proposed new code. A few of the major highlights of the revised code include creation of a chairperson roster consisting of public arbitrators with special qualifications, an increase in the number of proposed arbitrators on each of the three lists we will give to the parties. That is, a public chair list, a public arbitrator list for non-chairs, and an industry list. There will be a limited number of strikes. The object here is to give the parties more of an opportunity to make sure that the arbitrators whom they have selected will be on their final panel, rather than the staff having to use the extended list process. Incorporation of the existing dispositive motions practice, but with a more stringent standard for the grant of such a motion. And finally, placement of many of the provisions of the discovery guidelines into the body of the code. That's my report about the upcoming rules this year. Now I'd like to take another moment to tell you about an exciting initiative that's important to our arbitrators. Late last year, we established the Neutral Roster Task Force. The purpose of the task force is to further improve the quality and integrity of our roster, of our arbitrator roster, focusing on arbitrator issues such as classification, recruitment, retention and training, and finally, honorarium and other benefits. The task force is composed of arbitrators, mediators, public and industry representatives, and staff. We expect to make recommendations for enhancements after the completion of the task force's work. So as you can see, we had a very busy and productive 2005 and expect an equally busy 2006. With that, I will hand over the discussion to George Friedman, Dispute Resolution's Executive Vice President and Director of Arbitration. George will give a refresher on our expungement rule, Rule 2130. George?
Thank you, Linda, and thank you all for participating in today's call. It's been nearly 2 years since Rule 2130 on expungement went into effect in April 2004. So we'd like to take this chance to provide a quick review of the rule and its impact on arbitration and arbitrators. Very generally, Rule 2130 governs the standards that must be met and the procedures that must be followed when considering expungement requests. Today I will, one, talk about the evolution of Rule 2130, two, give an overview of the rule, three, discuss the specific findings that you, as arbitrators, must make before granting expungement, and four, explain how this rule applies to arbitration awards. First, some background information on CRD and its reporting requirements. CRD, which stands for Central Registration Depository, is an online registration and licensing system for the securities industry, state and federal regulators, and self-regulatory organizations, or SROs. NESD maintains and operates CRD under an agreement with the North American Securities Administrators Association, known as NASA. CRD maintains the qualification, employment, and disclosure histories of approximately 5,200 broker-dealers and about 668,000 associated persons. Brokerage firms and their registered persons are required to file initial applications for registration and to keep the information current in CRD. Both firms and their registered persons are also required to report certain criminal charges and convictions, regulatory actions, and bankruptcies, among other matters. In addition, registered persons are required to report certain customer complaints, including customer-initiated arbitration claims. When a registered person is named as a respondent in a customer-initiated claim, the claim and any allegations of wrongdoing contained in the claim must be reported on the registered person's Form U-4 or Form U-5. Once reported, this information is recorded in the CRD system and is available to the public through NESD's broker check program located at NESD's homepage, www.nesd.com. The process for removing this type of information from an individual CRD record is known as expungement. For years, registered persons sought relief in arbitration to expunge certain information from their CRD records. In January 1999, after consultation with NASA, NESD imposed a moratorium on arbitrator-ordered expungements of customer dispute information from the CRD system. Under the moratorium, NESD expunged customer dispute information from the CRD system only when a directive contained in an arbitration award was confirmed by a court of competent jurisdiction. After imposing the moratorium, NESD began to consider an approach to expungement that would allow NESD, in its capacity as an SRO and as operator of the CRD system, to effectively do the following. One, challenge expungement directives that might diminish or impair the integrity of the system. And two, ensure the maintenance of essential information for regulators and investors. We concluded that such an approach required a balancing of three competing interests. First, the interest of NESD, the states, and other regulators in retaining broad access to customer dispute information to fulfill their regulatory responsibilities and investor protection obligations. Second, the interest of the brokerage community in protecting their reputations by permitting expungement from the CRD system when it was appropriate to do so. And third, the interest of investors in having access to accurate and meaningful information about brokers with whom they conduct or may conduct business. These competing interests and the principles of investor protection, data integrity, and fairness guided NASD in drafting Rule 2130. Underlying this rule is NASD's commitment to maintain a CRD system that provides public investors and regulators access to information about firms and brokers and maintains the integrity of the arbitration process. Rule 2130, drafted in coordination with NASA, went into effect in April 2004 after extensive negotiations with NASA and a significant public comment process. Note that Rule 2130 is not a part of the Code of Arbitration procedure. Rather, it is an NASD conduct rule that establishes standards that must be met in order for expungement to be granted. It also establishes procedures for members and associated persons to follow to obtain expungement of customer dispute information. Rule 2130 has many implications for arbitrators, and dispute resolution staff work closely with NASD's regulatory division in drafting the rule and related procedures. Both groups continue to work together on the implementation process. Now that we've discussed Rule 2130's background, how does it apply to arbitrations? NASD will expunge customer dispute information from a CRD record only if ordered to do so by a court, regardless of when the claim was filed. Note that the requirements of Rule 2130 apply to claims filed on and after April 12, 2004. Again, claims that are filed on and after April 12, 2004. For claims filed before April 12, 2004, the requirements of the moratorium, as I explained earlier, continue to apply. Of course, arbitrators in such cases may still look to Rule 2130 for guidance as to whether expungement is warranted. The requirements of Rule 2130 that I will describe in a few moments apply only to cases that involve customer dispute information. Such cases typically involve public customers. Expungements ordered in arbitration cases between industry parties, that is, between individual registered persons and their firms, or between firms, based on the defamatory nature of the information, will continue to be honored without a court order. Perhaps an example will best illustrate this point. A broker might want to wish to expunge a statement on her Form U-5 stating that her former employer discharged her for poor performance. If she proves to the arbitrators that she actually resigned to take another job, the panel could find that the information on CRD was defamatory and order it to be expunged. This order does not involve any customer dispute information and need not be confirmed in court, so long as the award explicitly states that the expungement order is, quote, based on the defamatory nature of the information on CRD, unquote. However, if a party in an intra-industry case seeks to expunge customer dispute information, then that expungement request does become subject to the requirements of 2130. Again, an example. A terminated broker might seek to expunge a Form U-5 entry in which the firm said it fired him because of a customer complaint from John and Mary Smith. The complaint alleged that he had churned their account. Assuming the arbitrators found this language to be defamatory in nature, NASD would expunge this information from the termination disclosure and termination DRP sections of the Form U-5 without requiring court confirmation of the order. If, however, the arbitration ordered expungement of this information from any other section of the Form U-5 or from the Form U-4, the order is subject to the requirements of Rule 2130 with respect to the additional expungement relief. And again, there's more information on this on our webpage. Rule 2130 requires that a party seeking expungement, either in court litigation or through court confirmation of an arbitration award, name NASD as an additional party in that court proceeding, unless NASD waives that requirement. NASD may waive the requirement to be named as a party in the proceeding if it determines that the expungement relief requested is based on at least one of the affirmative findings required by Rule 2130. Let's talk about what the rule requires of arbitrators. Again, Rule 2130 applies only to cases filed on and after April 12, 2004. To effectively order expungement of a customer claim, arbitrators must explicitly make one of the following three findings. First, that the claim allegation or information is factually impossible or clearly erroneous. For example, an individual named in a customer arbitration claim was not employed or associated with the member firm during the relevant time. Or, two, The registered person was not involved in the alleged investment-related sales practice violation, forgery, theft, misappropriation, or conversion of funds. This standard would require an affirmative finding by the arbitrators that the registered person was not involved in any of the activities I just mentioned. Under this standard, mere dismissal of a claim by itself would not be a sufficient basis for ordering expungement. Or three, the claim, allegation, or information is false. This standard requires that the arbitrators assess the evidence and make an affirmative finding that the claim, allegation, or information is false. If the expungement order is based expressly on at least one of these three affirmative findings, NESD may waive its right to be named as a party to the court proceeding confirming the award. Now that I've laid out the rule and its standard, let's discuss briefly how arbitrators apply this rule in arbitration proceedings. In order to grant expungement relief in a customer dispute, the arbitrators must affirmatively state in the award that the expungement relief is based on one or more of the previously described affirmative standards articulated in Rule 2130. That is, arbitrators must clearly and expressly include in the award an affirmative finding on which the expungement is based. We've made changes to the award information sheet to ensure that arbitrators communicate information to staff about expungement issues raised during an arbitration proceeding and how they were resolved. At the conclusion of a hearing, arbitrators must complete the award information sheet. The information sheet, which is available on NESD's website, elicits pertinent information needed to properly and accurately draft an award. The award information sheet includes questions to obtain precise information about expungement requests made during an arbitration, the disposition of those requests, and the basis for granting expungement. Finally, the award information sheet includes a quick reference guide of procedures arbitrators should follow when applying Rule 2130. Now, if the arbitrators grant expungement relief, the registered person must still obtain confirmation of the award in a court of competent jurisdiction. As I mentioned before, under 2130, the registered person must name NESD as a party unless NESD has waived that requirement. Please keep in mind that expungement is extraordinary relief. Here are some guiding principles arbitrators might apply. Your finding of no liability on the part of the broker is not a sufficient ground, without more, for you to grant an expungement request. The dismissal of a claim, without more, is also an insufficient basis alone for ordering expungement. And of course, it's difficult to imagine a situation where an arbitrator can enter an adverse arbitration award against the registered person, yet still make an expungement determination under Rule 2130. Until now, we've discussed Rule 2130 in the context of contested arbitration claims where arbitrators render an award after a full evidentiary hearing. There may be cases, however, where parties reach a settlement and ask the arbitrators to incorporate their settlement into what's called a stipulated award. Stipulated awards that contain expungement relief are subject to the exact same requirements as contested awards. Let me repeat that one. Stipulated awards containing an expungement order are, under Rule 2130, subject to precisely the same requirements as contested arbitrations. Arbitrators must hear or review enough evidence to satisfy themselves that at least one of the three standards of Rule 2130 have been met. Often you may find that a hearing, telephonic or in person, will be necessary in order to adequately consider an expungement request and to determine if the party seeking expungement has met one or more of the three grounds articulated in Rule 2130. The cost of such a hearing will generally be assessed against the party requesting the expungement. Arbitrators who determine that expungement is warranted must expressly state in the stipulated award that the party seeking expungement has met at least one of the standards of Rule 2130. Arbitrators who believe they don't have enough information to make one of the three affirmative findings required by the rule have some options. First, they can ask parties to submit additional information. Second, assuming they have not already done so, arbitrators are encouraged to conduct a telephonic or in-person hearing to satisfy themselves that expungement is warranted. And third and last, arbitrators can decline to sign the stipulated award. Arbitrators should not be shy about asking questions to satisfy themselves that there's a basis under the rule to grant the expungement request. Please note that affirmative findings are required only for the granting of expungement relief. They are not required for other matters that the parties may have settled and incorporated into a stipulated award. Also remember that under the Code of Ethics for Arbitrators, you don't have to sign any stipulated award that grants expungement relief if, for example, parties have not demonstrated to you that they have met one or more of the standards in Rule 2130. Specifically, Canon 5D of the Code of Ethics, available on our webpage, states, and I quote, "In the event that all parties agree upon a settlement of issues in dispute and request the arbitrator to embody that agreement in an award, the arbitrator may do so, but is not required to do so unless satisfied with the propriety of the terms of settlement," unquote. Declining to sign a stipulated award containing expungement relief should not affect the validity of other terms of the party's underlying settlement. Finally, to reinforce the importance of Rule 2130 and its impact on the arbitration process and arbitrators, NESD will be publishing an article on expungement in an upcoming issue of our arbitrator newsletter, The Neutral Corner. The article, much like this refresher, will give a quick overview of Rule 2130 and emphasize the key points that will help arbitrators better comprehend this topic. All issues of The Neutral Corner can be found on our website under Resources for Neutral. This concludes our brief review of expungement. Now back to you, Linda.
Thanks, George. Let me clarify something first about the chairperson list under our new proposed code. Of course, in a case that has an all-industry panel, and those are quite limited in our forum today, the chair list and the chairperson for that panel will come from the industry. The public chair list, of course, will be for cases that have two public arbitrators and one industry arbitrator. And now on to the question and answer portion of our workshop. These are questions previously submitted by many of you that you emailed to us at our invitation, and we will try and address as many as we can. If you have any additional questions that were not answered today, please email or fax them to us after the workshop. You will have until February 21st to email your questions, and this is a long email address. I apologize for this. NASDDRNM@NASD.com. Let me repeat that. It stands for NASD Dispute Resolution Neutral Management, but let me give that to you again. NASDDRNM@NASD.com, or you can fax them to 1-646-625-6028. Again, 1-646-625-6028, and we will answer questions of general applicability on our website. Let me say first that we received several questions about arbitrator compensation. Before I respond to the specifics, I want again to mention that arbitrator honoraria is one of the topics that the Neutral Roster Task Force is examining in its mission to enhance the arbitrator roster. But as I am sure you all understand, we are limited in our ability to make substantial increases to the honoraria by the requirements of being a self-regulatory organization subject to SEC review. We are required to offer inexpensive dispute resolution to public investors. And as I said, this does limit our ability to make any substantial increases to arbitrator honoraria. We had one question about whether arbitrators can be compensated for last-minute cancellations or postponements after they are en route or have arrived at the hearing venue. Now, for last-minute cancellations, we compensate arbitrators $100 each for settlement or postponement requests granted within 3 business days of a regular hearing session. The rate of compensation is the same whether or not the arbitrators travel outside of their immediate hearing area. If possible, before you leave for a hearing, we strongly encourage you to contact your case administrator to confirm that the hearing is going forward. Although we do our best to notify you when a case is not going forward, settlements may occur outside of normal business hours. We also ask that you provide us with any alternative phone numbers or email addresses that we may not have on file for you, even if it is just for that day. These steps allow us to reach you quickly and may help avoid your making an unnecessary trip. We have another arbitrator who has asked, who asked the following question: whether arbitrators who may spend hours going over extensive discovery motions should receive some form of compensation for their time if a discovery conference is canceled less than 48 hours before the scheduled time. Although we provide compensation to arbitrators when a hearing on the merits is canceled at the last minute, we do not have a similar provision for telephonic conferences. However, as I mentioned, we recently amended our rules to provide compensation to arbitrators for ruling on a discovery-related motion when no telephonic hearing is held. Each arbitrator who participates in deciding a discovery motion on the papers will be compensated $200. Now a question on last minute settlements. An arbitrator says, "I fully understand the importance of fostering settlements as well as the pressures a looming hearing can add to the settlement process. Is there anything further NASD can do to encourage earlier settlements of cases rather than on the eve of hearings?" We, of course, agree that it would be preferable for parties to settle disputes earlier in the arbitration process, and the process fees assessed against firms are designed to do just this. We also provide a financial incentive to the parties to settle more than 3 business days prior to the commencement of the hearing. As you know, the compensation we provide to arbitrators for the inconvenience of a last-minute settlement, that is one within 3 business days of the commencement of the hearing, is assessed against the parties as a cancellation fee. Nevertheless, as you all know, it is the party's case, and we cannot force them to settle sooner if they elect not to. A question about recruitment from one of you. Why is NASD recruiting more arbitrators when some arbitrators on the roster do not get appointed to cases? We actively recruit arbitrators in our new hearing locations and in other locations where we have fewer arbitrators to serve on cases. In addition to expanding the roster in certain locations, we are committed to diversifying our present roster of arbitrators. It is important that we offer parties a diverse choice of backgrounds. Some investor attorneys, for example, prefer to have some arbitrators on their panels who do not have securities law experience. This is not so different, after all, from court, where judges who do not have knowledge in a particular area of the law are called upon to decide a matter involving that area. Ultimately, a diverse roster of neutrals representing a broad cross-section of people better serves all of our constituents. Moreover, the reason that arbitrators do not get appointed to cases is not primarily related to the number of arbitrators on the roster in the various locations. The primary reason for non-appointment is the exercise of strikes by the parties. As you know, under the current list selection system, parties have unlimited strikes. This will change under the revised code, which will provide for limited strikes. Another arbitrator asks, does an arbitrator have the right to award attorney's fees to a party in a non-statutory employment discrimination case? Although attorney fees are not often granted, arbitrators do have the authority to consider awarding attorney fees if all the parties request or agree to such fees. For example, parties may have agreed to attorney fees in a signed contract or promissory note. Please keep in mind, however, that the procedure to grant attorney fees varies from state to state. It may be appropriate to request that the parties brief this issue. If the panel awards attorney's fees, the award information sheet requires the panel to indicate what supporting authority it is relying upon. Another arbitrator asks, parties often agree to postpone an arbitration hearing in order to explore their mediation options without seeking permission from the panel. What is NASD's position on these types of postponements? If all the parties agree to mediate a matter through NASD, the arbitration proceeding will be adjourned automatically. As I noted, we encourage settlement between the parties. By allowing parties to adjourn an arbitration hearing at no cost, we aid the parties to reach the optimal resolution to their dispute. Another question relating to postponement. Is it normal practice for arbitrators to decide postponement requests by individually reviewing the materials and then indicating a decision on a document to be returned to the case administrator? Generally, arbitrators will review the request to postpone and will confer with each other before making a decision. However, there are times when the process is altered because of time constraints. In such instances, it is not unusual for the case administrator to poll all the arbitrators to obtain their rulings on the postponement request. Of course, arbitrators are always welcome to call each other and to discuss any motion before making a ruling. Another question, and this is our final question for today. Please provide arbitrators with some guidance as to how long they should retain materials after a case has gone to hearing or has settled prior to a hearing. At the conclusion of a hearing, the chairperson is responsible for collecting the official set of accepted exhibits and providing them to NASD to archive. For all other case-related materials, including duplicates of the exhibits, arbitrators may dispose of them as soon as the hearing concludes or a case settles. There is no requirement to retain case-related materials for any set period of time. Of course, however, you may need to retain your copy of the exhibit until the panel has concluded its deliberations and determined what award it will issue. In conclusion, let me remind you about our continuous efforts to enhance arbitrator training. Since rolling out our first online course in 2003, we've developed a series of online arbitrator mini-courses on subject-specific topics. Except for expungement, which is mandatory, all of our current online courses are voluntary. Our mini-courses give arbitrators a more thorough understanding of key issues, and the arbitrator disclosure reports submitted to the parties during list selection reflect an arbitrator's completion of these courses. In December 2005, we added two new mini-courses. The first is titled Direct Communication and discusses the benefits of proceeding under the direct communication rule, which I discussed with you earlier in this workshop. The second is titled Understanding the Pre-Hearing Stage. This course assists arbitrators to organize the pre-hearing conference, keeps the parties focused on the tasks at hand, and provides practical guidance from the arbitrators to the parties on other preliminary issues that may arise. You can access all of the online training courses for which you sign up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 30 days. We encourage you to visit our website to register for these courses. And since we've mentioned our website several times today, let me remind you of that web address, www.nasd.com. Again, www.nasd.com. That concludes today's workshop. We invite you to listen to a free replay of this workshop by calling MCI at 1-800-685-0932, and that will be available 1 hour after this call concludes. It will be available through March 14, 2006 at 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. After March 14th, you can find an audio recording of this workshop on our website, the site to which I just gave you. Again, thank you for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed today's workshop and found it informative. And I will now sign off.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.